Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for June 7th, 2018. Moving on halfway through the year right now, and tonight I'll be doing my annual hurricane prediction, and I'm going to predict that we will have one named storm so far. No, I'm just kidding. Last year, in fact, the National Hurricane Prediction Center made their predictions, and they added one to it because there had already been one hurricane. So anyway, that's just comical to me. And then I'll also be talking about their annual hurricane prediction, which is usually pretty hokey. It's like, well, there's a 35% chance that we're going to have a slightly above average hurricane season this year. You know, that's, what do we have, 45 PhDs working in the National Hurricane Prediction Center and NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and that's what you get? Excuse me. I can only laugh, but if it weren't so pathetic, because you're paying for that. You get to pay for that. And then I'll be talking a little bit at the end about propulsion systems, but many topics to cover tonight. And just remember that my paid cast, I am concentrating right now on propulsion systems. Well, why would I talk about that? Because I invented, and this is back in the early 1980s, as part of my research into the electrical nature of the universe, I realized that there were electric currents, and to ride those electric currents to the planets and stars using comets, the discharge of the comet as braking. And so I said that's the way that the Creator designed the universe, for us to travel amongst the stars, riding the electric currents. And in fact, so I sat down and I said, self, there's got to be a way to use these electrical currents just like the sailors of old used the wind. And so I sat down and I invented not one, but two propulsion systems. And the reason I'm talking about this in my paid cast is because I'm in the middle of the series of lectures on my books. So I'm talking about the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And in there, you can see one of the publications from, probably that was done at around 1986. And the topic was this one propulsion system. So you can read about it there. And the other propulsion system, I have not divulged, because the one propulsion system that I made public was basically stolen from me by the aerospace giants out in California. Anyway, that's a long story. So make sure you sign up for my paid cast talking about propulsion systems in detail, everything from jet engines to propeller-driven airplanes to scramjets and ramjets and rocket engines and nuclear rocket engines, all kinds of things. So make sure you join my paid cast. It's just $3.95 a month. Okay, this is a funny story. Elon Musk, this past week, now there was a lot of fanfare. Remember, everybody was going to go to Mars. And Elon Musk even challenged Boeing, saying that he would get to Mars before Boeing. And so there was kind of like a little contest. And of course, NASA wants to go to Mars, but NASA can't get a mouse into space. Right now, they have really no capability. In fact, the astronauts that just went to the space station went over to Russia, and they launched out of central Russia. That just went off. So there's, the U.S. has no manned space capability at all. But they're talking about going to Mars. But anyway, this past week, Elon Musk stepped back, and without much fanfare and without a reason, stated that he was not going to have tourists going around the moon in 2018. Now let's just take a look at the the reality check here. If you Elon Musk is selling tickets for people to go around the moon and come back. Now, they have not sent any spacecraft unmanned to go around the moon and come back, nor have they really had a lot of experience sending unmanned spacecraft into low Earth orbit. And the first thing would probably be to have a number of successful rocket trips into low Earth orbit to take people to the International Space Station, for example. That would give you docking experience. That would give you re-entry experience with humans on board, etc. But they haven't even done that. And also, if you had experienced people, now, you know, to just go in a space capsule and sit there for a week as you go orbit the moon and then come back, I mean, you have to have people that are trained. It's not just like, oh, you're hanging out at the bar out in L.A. or up in, you know, wherever, is, you know, out of San Francisco somewhere, and you think, yeah, I'm a rich guy, I'm going to put a bunch of money down, and I think I'll go sit in a space capsule for a week. I can drink my martinis there just as well as I can drink them here in the bar down in San Francisco. And so pay for a trip around the moon and come back. Excuse me. You know, I think somebody's, I'll be honest with you, I think they're off their rocker. If you have never sent a spacecraft around the moon with all of the sensors and all of the required testing and safety, et cetera, and our knowledge that NASA has an entire program called Living with a Star, that's kind of a secret program, but it was aimed at deciding how they could get through the Van Allen belts and then deal with other space radiation when you're outside of the Van Allen belts and outside of Earth's protective magnetic field. So I just think that, well, clearly these people are dreaming. You know, and he had his heavy launch rocket, the Falcon Heavy launched, very successful. You know, but still, we're talking about sending people around the moon. And nobody has done this. Allegedly, it was done. NASA claims they did it in the 1969 era, up to, with six flights, 18 people to the moon and back. That would put 12 men landing on the moon and walking around and doing their thing and coming back with no harm done. But I think we all, even the people who are real NASA rah-rah believers, have to put a little bit of shred of doubt into this claim. And so anyway, okay, enough of that. But I just thought that was comical that Elon backed off of sending two people to the moon this year. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about a couple videos that I saw this week that were very impressive. And you can go on YouTube, which I don't recommend YouTube, but there's some good stuff there. I just tell people, do not get your science on YouTube. But there was a YouTube video about the Golden Gate Bridge being built in the 1930s. And this was quite an operation. Now, I've been at the Golden Gate Bridge. I hope you have been at the Golden Gate Bridge out in San Francisco and tour San Francisco, go down to the, you know, fish market off of Fisherman's Wharf, and oh my goodness, everything in San Francisco. Just so many things to do there. The streetcars, you know, the electric streetcars that have been there forever, and the bay, and, you know, all of the tourist trips that you can take, etc. But anyway, Golden Gate Bridge, what a phenomenal, phenomenal piece of work. And of course, now there's many other bridges out there, the Bay Bridge, and you know, you get on these bridges, they're pretty phenomenal. But in its day, 1930s, nobody thought that you could build a bridge across the Golden Gate, which is the entryway, it's the cut, with the huge currents and waves and wind and storms and fog. And they built this within about a 5-6 year period from the time they started. And then, okay, number two, Hoover Dam and the other great dams, the Tennessee Valley Association, the dams, etc. And then thirdly, the underground bases. Now, there's, I'll see if I can post a link on my webpage, but there's a lot of information to where people now have specific entry locations for the underground base system in the United States. And so you can look that up too. Let me I'm going to pull that up just quickly. Okay, I'm going to read this off. I'll do it twice, so get a piece of paper. Maybe I'll do it at the end also. But this is a great video elucidating the entry points of the ground underground bases in the United States. So I'll read this off, and then I'll read it off again a little bit later. Or if you haven't gotten time to get a pencil, come back and listen to this show on the archive. We're at about what time into the show here? Almost 11 minutes into the show. So the address here is https://. YouTube with a dot in the middle is YouTube.BE/ELS, capital E, capital W, capital G, capital N, little n, big C, N, G. So I'll quick read that again. https://YOUTU.BE/ELS, those were my new small letters, capital EWGN, those are all caps, EWGN, little n, big C, little n, little g. Okay, about underground bases. Anyway, maybe I'll try and read that at the end of the show. So, those are three mega projects that are really worth looking at on the internet and looking at the construction of those, etc. The Golden Gate Bridge, the Hoover Dam, and the underground bases. And the reason I like these videos about these mega projects is because I'm sitting on top of a mega project. A couple of them, actually. I have a subpage on my webpage. They're called the 11 Mega Earth Projects that have to be done. One of them is draining the lake at Yellowstone, and there's some other ones there dealing with harvesting water, etc. Okay, so enough of that. Golden Gate Bridge, 1930s video, Hoover and other great dams, the Tennessee Valley Association, and underground bases, that URL I just read you. Okay, quick note on volcanism. The Hawaii volcano. Now, here's some commentary. Everybody looks at the Hawaiian volcano, and it's bad. Many houses have been burned, but these people built their houses in a lava flow area, which is, if you look at especially the Big Island of Hawaii, which is the active island of Hawaii, if you go to other islands in the Hawaiian chain going northwest, they are not active. There's Haleakala on Maui, which is on the east end of Maui, which has not been active for a long time. They've actually built research stations up there. The military has a tremendous research station up there with lasers and telescopes and supercomputers, etc. But as far as active volcanoes, it's pretty much limited to that southeastern corner of Hawaii. Although within the past, 200 years, there have been many lava flows that have breached on the various regions of Hawaii. But given that the world's most active volcano, Kilauea, is up on this hillside, one has to ponder the question, why would you build a house there down below that mountain? So anyway, but in terms of being a bad eruption, the lava in Hawaii just kind of flows. It spits and it sputters, and on a global scale, it's not that explosive. It had a couple explosive events where some ash went off, but let's look at the volcano in Guatemala called Fuego, which means fire. So it's the volcano of fire, and it's really one of the most active volcanoes in the world also. Then again, why would you build or put your livelihood at the base of this mountain. And when it blew off, it was unexpected. Nobody expected it. It just went ha-whammo. And, of course, unfortunately, many people died. And the ash that fell, etc., of course, you can't breathe. You can't see. You know, it's, if you were living anywhere near the base of that mountain, you were probably ended up. So a lot of people died there, unfortunately. But then again, you know, you have to ask the question, why are people building structures there? Mexico City, for example, has the two active volcanoes, Popocatépetl and Iztaccíhuatl. And when I was living in Mexico City as a young guy, I would get up in the morning, and I lived up in the what is known as the Tacubaya area, and I'd look out my window, and I would see across the basin, which is Mexico City, to the east were the two volcanoes. And recently they have been acting up. The Popocatépetl volcano has been acting up. And if that baby blew, you know, and the winds are coming from the east, it could do a lot of damage to Mexico City, which, of course, had a major earthquake in 1980, I believe it was. But, you know, in the volcanically earthquake-active area. So Yellowstone, once again, we have to drain the lake. And volcanologists, amazingly, are starting to wake up to the fact that I've been preaching all along that volcanoes, the explosive ones, the explosions are caused by steam, where the water gets down, hits the magma, and basically you got a steam engine of cosmic proportions. Okay, so here's another story. This was Science for Students. Now, this was on a page saying, called Science News. And if you're not familiar, dark matter is it's an invention of science that they needed to resolve what they are called the velocity or the light curves of galaxies. So you have a galaxy, you all know what those look like, a spiral galaxy. And the stars in the spiral arms are orbiting somehow around the nucleus. And so anyway, when they examined the velocity curves using light measurements, using the redshift and the blue shift, they realized that the stars were not moving according to Newtonian physics. In other words, gravity. So there was something else going on. So instead of pursuing other alternative mechanisms, they decided that there had to be some missing matter. And so it turns out that there has to be so much missing matter or dark matter that it is more than the mass of the galaxy combined. And so it's really it's a counterintuitive concept. But this past week, I talk about that, by the way, I have a DVD number 4, which talks about cosmology. That's a good DVD if you want a full-blown explanation of all of that and to prove why there is no Big Bang, etc. But at any rate, this past week, scientists came out and decided that dark matter could have fusion. In other words, our sun, the energy we see coming from the sun, we know is caused by fusion. The only difference, I say it's up in the atmosphere, and standard science says that it's down in the core of the sun. But be that as it may, now they're talking about fusion related to dark matter. Well, that's really wonderful, but they can't even tell you what dark matter is. They don't know what its properties are. All they know that it acts like a gravitational source, but it doesn't block light. It doesn't absorb light. It doesn't modify light. It's not detectable in any form that we know. And so how do they then assume or postulate that this can have fusion? And if it did have fusion, then wouldn't you see dark matter fusion energy of some sort in the form of electromagnetic radiation or something? Anyway, just wanted to drop that little piece of information. Also on the same science page, they were talking about, once again, this is disinformation for students, coming from the standard scientific community. They're still talking about the alleged asteroid that hit Earth and caused the alleged demise of the dinosaurs. And in their model, they claim that all animals within 4,000 miles of where the alleged asteroid hit, all animals would have died. Okay, this is what they're claiming in this article. This is theoretical. And then they're talking about firestorms, and then they say, well, the birds survived because they could fly in trees, you know, and they somehow had a better survival rate. But many years ago, a group of scientists went down to Yucatan, and this is where they believe that the crater is where the asteroid allegedly hit that allegedly killed the dinosaurs. And what they discovered was that all around the rim were dinosaur remains that had built up long after the crater had formed. In other words, there was no extinction event, and it wasn't even a local extinction event, let alone 4,000 miles away. So this is a good example of how scientists continue with their narrative in spite of the fact that it's evidence, clear evidence to the contrary. And so, unfortunately, these, you know, the Big Bang, the demise of the dinosaur by an asteroid, and I'm thoroughly convinced that it was a large comet coming through the solar system that caused the demise of the dinosaurs. It fits the narrative or the story that we see. It fits it much better than a single crashing asteroid. But all I'm saying is that the poor students today are being barraged by this phony baloney science that really has been disproven thoroughly, yet it continues to go on. The reason I keep pounding on this and the issue at schools is that the schools have become the biggest tool of the deep state in miseducating our kids. And really, you know, the textbooks that couldn't possibly be true, you know, teaching economics that really has nothing to do with how economics really works, you find that people that understand economics have worked in the business world and, you know, have done, say, international dealings. It's fairly complicated. So you have people like, say, Obama or Bush, who have never operated even a small company, let alone the economy of the United States. Get serious. You know, how can these people even imagine they could run the United States and they couldn't even run a McDonald's stand successfully? Okay, so anyway, the point is that schools are really the bastion, the cornerstone of the deep state disinformation. And not only did they not teach correct information, not only did they teach completely false information, but they don't give students the tools they need once they get out, either socially. And I was talking about with somebody just this past week about this, the fact that parents send their kids to school and they assume that, well, they're educating my kid. And so parents don't educate their kids anymore. So kids grow up making the same mistakes over and over again that have occurred for, you know, forever. There's no instruction of how you should live, what kind of person you should be. You know, here's what you should be doing. Here's how you should be acting. You know, and then parents don't interact when their kids have problems. They rarely talk to them. The kids try and solve it on their own, but we don't have any generational wisdom being passed down to kids these days. It's really unfortunate. Which brings up a quick topic. I'm just going to mention this, voter ignorance. And you find all over the place that people really don't know what they're talking about when it comes to basically understanding how the country works and what's best for the country. So anyway, I'm not going to go into that tonight. I try and keep away from those topics, but this is a part of science education. If people understand science, and that's something that a lot of people comment about my science, it's not just a hodgepodge of statements that don't fit together and you just memorize them, like Carl Sagan used to say, you just memorize these answers, leave the thinking up to us, and don't question it because they're smart and you're stupid. That's the Carl Sagan philosophy of teaching. So I don't believe that. I believe that science is cohesive. There's a cohesiveness between our understanding of the universe and our spiritual and mental understanding and connection to it, along with all the different ways that the universe works. And the universe works very simply. Now, it's not complicated. So when man gets in the picture and complicates everything, that's when things tend to go south. Okay, I'm going to do a little hurricane prediction here. And first I'll lead off with the Hurricane Prediction Center prediction. Okay, so it's a very bland prediction that came out this year. And it's almost like they are just trying to be completely, what would you call it? Like neutral. I guess that's the best word. So at any rate, here's the NOAA prediction that came out May 24th, that there would be 10 to 16 named storms, that there would be 5 to 9 hurricanes, and that there would be 1 to 4 major hurricanes. Now, the reason this is interesting is because let's look at the record high and record low. For number of named storms, the high is 28, the low is 4. And so the average is 12. So they put their prediction right smack dab around the average, which is 10 to 16. Then look at the number of, and there's a number of these groups that are making these predictions. So the number of hurricanes on average is 6. The record high activity was 15 hurricanes, and the record low activity was 2. And so what do? They say 5 to 9. So, gee, they're right in the middle. They go a little low, they go a little high, you know, from the average. And then the number of major hurricanes on average is 2 to 3 per year. The record high of major hurricanes was 7, and the record low was 0. And so what do they say? They say 1 to 4. So once again, they wrap it right around that average, a little lower, a little higher. And my goodness, these people get paid to do this. So anyway, it's not really worth talking about because it's really meaningless. It would be like me making a prediction that between now and next Christmas, it's going to rain, you know, and we're going to have an above average number of days of rain by 2%. But I'll say that we might have less than normal, but we might have more than normal. Now, would you base your family vacation on that prediction? Well, of course not. It doesn't mean anything. So anyway, when I make predictions, it's based on actual reality. And of course, there's many factors when you understand my scientific work. And the fact that weather is created by the electrical conditions in the solar system, it has nothing to do with this randomness that they talk about, or statistical, relying on past statistics or whatever. But in fact, there are real causes for storms. And that's the main point, that a hurricane doesn't just happen. Like, you know, there's that other expression, blank happens. Hurricanes just don't happen. It's not a statistical thing. It's not based on numbers out of the past. It's based on energy. It takes energy to create a hurricane. And they have the idea that it just moves across this warm water, and sometimes they form and sometimes they don't. They don't have any explanation. And when you have something as big and powerful as a hurricane, and you cannot identify the energy source that causes this, they say warm water, But the Atlantic Ocean has been very cool, plus the biggest storms in history have been in the raging north frigid, icy cold Atlantic Ocean. And they don't talk about those as hurricanes, though. They call them temperate cyclones. They give them another name. But we have had hurricanes off the west coast of Washington. We've had hurricanes off of Alaska. We've had the three big hurricanes that formed the so-called perfect storm, the winter, the fall. It was the October, if you were in the upper Midwest in October, late October, of 1991. I remember it well because I happened to be there. And it snowed and it blew and it raged for a number of days in a row, leaving 36 inches of snow. And then the eye of the storm passed over. This is in the upper Midwest. And then it snowed another 30 inches. And, for example, Minnesota, very prepared for snow, big machines and sand and snow and salt on the roads to prepare for the so the people can drive around. Because in that climate, if you wait for a nice day, you're going to be waiting a long time, buddy. So they have to be prepared to keep things moving. So anyway, this storm locked everything down. Nothing could move. It was just amazing. So anyway, for days and days and days, nobody could move. The trucks, the big trucks were stuck in snowbanks, etc. Anyway, so here's my prediction for this year for hurricanes. And it's a extremely bland year. We don't have comets, and let's talk about this, that we know about yet. I mean, we could always have a comet come in and have some activity. But back in the old Hale-Bopp days, we had quite a bit of hurricane activity, and it was very predictable. Some of my major hurricane predictions were done in that era because the sun was very, very active, and the solar capacitor was charged up and very powerful, and the Hale-Bopp, the comet, was discharging the solar capacitor, which made the sun's atmosphere very supercharged, and a lot of solar flares. We had X-class flares every day, two, three, four, five of them, and that was leading into the solar maximum that was around the year 2000. So what's the solar conditions now? We're heading into a solar minimum. They get excited when they say, when there's a C-class flare, it's not even worth calling a flare. It's like a hiccup. It's not even a hiccup. It's like a baby burp on the sun. And so it's just a little excess from normal. So C-class events on the sun are pretty minimal. It's almost like the sun is always in a C-class state. And so anyway, they get very excited when there's anything that even approaches an M-class, but we had X-class flares many times per day back in the Hale-Bopp era, and so a lot of solar electrical activity, which drives our storms. Without this electrical activity, we would not have storms, but right now, we're heading into a solar minimum. We've had an entire 12 years or more, probably about 15 years, of extremely low solar activity. And that is because Hale-Bopp took off. It's not discharging the solar capacitor, and it discharged the solar capacitor. All that energy went into building that planet. Hale-Bopp, which is now very well on its way out of the solar system, not to come back for another 2,600 years to where it will re-enter the solar system and possibly have an encounter with Earth. Hale-Bopp's orbit crosses Earth's orbit perpendicular to the ecliptic, the plane of the planets. And so it's very hard to predict where that thing is going to be on its next trip around. And I suspect nobody listening to this show will have to worry about that because that's 2,600 years away. But we do not have any active comets, big ones, in the solar system now. And even if we did, they would probably be fairly low energy unless we had a real, real direct connection with one of them in the proximity of Earth. So the sun is very weak. We're heading into a solar minimum. We don't have a lot of energy in the sun. And so anyway, here are the dates. Everybody loves dates. The 10th of May, looking back at Alberto, was when we made a perfect electrical alignment between Jupiter and Earth. And so I would directly connect Alberto with the Jupiter winds. And if you were probably in other places around the globe during that time, the month of May, from around the 10th of May onwards, then you could have experienced some excessive wind activity. Okay, moving on to July 26th is when we have an electrical alignment with Mars. But Mars is really a non-entity out there. Unless there were some other planet involved, like a Jupiter on the other side of Mars, then Mars is not going to cause a lot of activity. But what happens is we get somewhat of a triple alignment towards the end of July and very early August, where that might be a good time for auroras. Is early August, I'd say maybe the 2nd or 3rd of August. Take a trip out, go out to the northern states, up to the border country between the northern border of the United States and Canada, and potentially that might be a good time, or even into Canada, that might be a good time to see some auroras. And of course, the auroras are occurring all the time around the Arctic Circle. They're always up there. So, but not many people venture that far north. Okay, so anyway, that's the end of July from about the 26th, right after that Mars opposition, and then the Mercury inferior conjunction on August 6th. So somewhere in that time frame, but there again, those are fairly weak interactions. And by the way, none of these correspond with a new moon passing. So then we go all the way to the end of October, where we have a Venus and Earth electrical connection. And that's around the 27th, right before Halloween. So we could have some Halloween winds due to the fact that Venus inferior conjunction, or we could have a Venus virus event coming in at the end of October, just in time for kids to get sick right before Halloween. And then the very last one of the year, the 11th month, November 29th, where we have another Mercury encounter. But none of these are associated with a new moon passing. None of them are associated with multiple planetary alignments. And we have a very weak sun. We have very weak electrical currents in the solar system. Remember that going back to the late July, early August time frame, that is when we cross through the return current sheet of the sun. So the fact that we have a Mars-Mercury-Earth connection along with the return current sheet could give us some activity, but I would say possibly not hurricanes, maybe, but it's not a strong indication, but I would say that makes it a very strong indicator for auroral activity. And those are just beautiful. If you've never seen them, take some time out. And if we happen to have a solar storm at that time, that would enhance it all the more. So anyway, that is my annual prediction for hurricanes 2018. In other words, a very lackluster year, very much below normal, and unless something happens, unless something literally comes into the solar system like a comet and gives us a real direct interaction with Earth of some kind. But other than that, apart from that happening, and I'm not saying that will happen, I have no reason to think it will, although comets can come into the solar system at any time, not a problem, but we don't know of any at this time that would do that. Okay, so I'm going to continue talking here about power stations, and this is very important. because you are constantly being barraged by stories about power stations and how much power that they do, etc., how much power they give off. But the idea that somehow solar panels, these big, vast arrays of solar panels or wind generators, are somehow going to relieve us of this. And by the way, China is one of the best examples. They are learning in China, and they've cut way back on the installation of solar panels this year to the point where they are not going to install any more solar in China for the rest of this year. And the analysts who analyze markets, worldwide markets, etc., are saying that this is due to Trump blocking solar panels. But he did that a long time ago, blocking solar panels from China coming into the USA. But understand, there's a lot of sales that come from the United States, solar panels into China to help fill that market, because the Chinese have been installing solar panels like crazy for probably about 5 years right now. And all of a sudden, just this past week, they said, we are going to put a moratorium on installing more solar panels. And finally, the Chinese have woken up to the fact that solar panels are not a good solution. Let us imagine, and now they're talking about putting in 110 gigawatts of solar. In other words, an average, let's say the big coal-fired power plant down on the Navajo Nation, which I talked about last week. By the way, I said it would put out 500 megawatts. Really, it's much bigger than that. It puts out, there's three stations there. There's three tall smoke stacks. And underneath each one of those is a generator and a big turbine. And each one of those can produce in the 700 megawatt range, so that the whole installation is nameplated for about 2.4 gigawatts. And it runs at maybe 60% of that, but it is rated literally at 2.2 gigawatts, or 2,200 megawatts is the amount of energy that can be put out by that power plant. But China has installed about half of that over the past 5 years, up to 110 they put in about 50 times that in terms of solar panels. So it's a tremendous, tremendous, tremendous amount of solar panels that have been installed in China. And all of a sudden this past week, they said, no more. We're not going to install any more for the whole rest of the year. And as I said, the financial market crashed. Some of these solar companies, their stock went down by as much as 30% this last week, just went wham. I mean, these companies will possibly be out of business by the end of the year because a big chunk of their business was in China, sending products that way, not coming this way. We always think of solar panels and electronics being built in China and coming into the U.S., but that was not the case. But anyway, it is not a financial issue. China has finally woken up to the fact that solar panels don't work. Now, what do I mean by they don't work? Sure, that when the sun is shining down, it creates electricity, and it creates electricity, goes out on the grid. That's great, but what happens when it rains one day? It's not a good constant source of power. And then when you go to nighttime, it doesn't give you anything. After 4 in the afternoon, you're not getting a dribble out of those solar panels. So you have a real problem. You have a real problem. And so the Chinese are figuring out, here's the problem, that because of the variability in the output of the solar panels, the more you put in and the bigger dependency you put on those, then all of a sudden, when it starts to rain, you're sitting there unable to provide power to the people or industry. And so it doesn't work. So what do? They literally don't use them. They literally don't use them because you can't take a power plant You can't take a 2-gigawatt power plant and all of a sudden fire it up and have it running online in 10 minutes. You cannot do it. And so anyway, it's the end result is the more solar panels you put in, the worse it gets. So the more solar panels you put in, the less of a solution solar panels are. And the more you put in, the sooner you're going to hit that point at which it takes over a big chunk, say in a small localized area, it might take over the production, and they'll brag and they'll go, oh, today we burned 80% of our capacity of electricity use was provided by solar. Okay, but as soon as 4 o'clock in the afternoon comes, now you got to turn on this mega coal plant or hydro plant or whatever and start producing energy. It's not a good system. And then when the surge hits, which you cannot control when you're bringing up a big power plant, it's not like jumping out into your car and going down to the grocery store where your engine is revving up. And no, a power plant takes time to get up and stabilize and reconnect the load, etc. So China has finally figured out that solar is not a solution. It's a very expensive non-solution. And so they're finally realizing that. But let me go through some of these numbers just to illustrate how the press tries to make this sound good. And I'm just going to correct a few numbers that I gave last week. The plant in Arizona, I said last week was 500 megawatts. I was just using that as a round number as an example, but it's 2.2 gigawatts. And so on the average, if you take that number and you divide it by the 1,300 watts continuous power usage in an average home, you end up with about 1.7 million homes that would be powered by that power plant. Now, they had installed an installation on the Navajo Reservation. It was the very first solar panel array, large-scale project that they put in on some sacred ground, and there was a lot of controversy over that, but they put in 120,000 solar panels. Okay, and they said this would power 18,000 homes. Well, they would power that many homes at 1,300 watts each during the peak solar time. In other words, if the sun was at high noon and it's shining down on these solar panels and there was no clouds in the sky, they could briefly supply energy for 18,000 homes. But the industry standard says that there's 4 solar hours per day. And so the end result is that what do you do for the rest of the time? So 4 times 6 is 24. So there are 6 4-hour units in the daytime. So 1/6 of your time is covered. So you need what you're providing. You're providing for 18,000 homes 1/6 of the day. Or the other way you could say that is you could provide for 3,000 homes for a 24-hour period on average. These are averages. So that 120,000 solar panel array can only power 3,000 houses is the end result. And so I did some further calculations, and these numbers came out about correct, that they would have to install. Now, okay, this is one installation. It's the Navajo very first installation of solar, 120,000 solar panels in one unit. So we're going to call that a unit. Imagine out in the desert, 120,000 solar panels all connected together to provide electricity. Okay, now to replace that power plant, you would need 450 of these 120,000 solar panel arrays to bring it up to produce that amount of energy. But that's only for 4 hours of the day. So you can see how far away solar is from solving the problem. And so this is the bait. This is like when you go fishing, let me explain an example. You put your bait on the hook, and then sometimes you take another little hook. It's called a stinger hook in fishing. So you got your regular normal size hook, and off of that comes another little hook, and it's got a little piece of bait on there. And the big hook, of course, has your big piece of bait. So the fish might come along, and if it's kind of like a day and the fish aren't really biting well, sometimes they come up and they just kind of like push on the food. They don't really eat it. So they come up seeing that big chunk on the big hook, and they just kind of push it. They don't really bite the hook. But you can get them on that stinger hook, and that's what the stinger hook is for. So this initial array of solar panels on the Navajo Nation is like the stinger hook that makes them think that, oh, if we just put in enough of these, then we would get energy and replace our coal-fired power plant. And so it's like the stinger hook. It's enough to get them hooked into buying more and more and more. But then you get to the point where the Chinese have come to the realization that now they've installed all of this solar. It only works part of the day. And if the sun goes away, then it just shuts down. And now all of a sudden they got to fire up that coal-fired or natural gas power plant. And it's when you get something, when you bring something online, it takes a lot of energy. So the end result is it actually costs more energy at the coal-fired plant or the natural gas plant. China has moved over to liquid propane, liquid natural gas, I guess they call it, LNP, LNG, I'm sorry, liquid natural gas. And it comes in on these massive ships with big steel globes that hold the liquid propane. But China has moved over to that, and they're importing just tons of it. They're doubling their consumption of natural gas for power, creating electricity, and trying to get rid of coal because the pollution in China is just horrendous. Okay, so anyway, the Chinese have figured out that solar panels are not the solution. So they slam dunk this week, put the hand down on the table and said, no more solar. We're not going to allow any more solar panels to be installed this week. So this is a very important realization. And that's when I wrote my book, which you can read, you can find it online, called McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project. I knew about this problem, and that's why it had to be solved. And that's what I call distributed energy. Distributed energy is the concept that, let's say, okay, with solar, the sun is shining part of the time, and then when the sun goes down, it's not shining at all. Wind is different in that the wind blows day and night, all different hours of the day, but you might be in a place today where there's no wind blowing at all. No wind at all. And so you go, well, how could wind be a solution for energy? Well, there are places where the wind is blowing, and what my studies have shown is that the average wind energy across the entire United States on a given day is a constant. And you cannot say that about solar, because there might be storms, but the absolute fact about solar is, even on a big country like the United States or China, that the sun is not going to shine at night. From late afternoon to somewhere 10 in the morning, you're really not going to get much out of your solar panels. So there's a guaranteed time every day when you're not going to get energy from solar panels. And there's no time average, like it's going to the sun is in one spot and not the other. No. Sun, it's either there or it ain't there. And most of the time, it's not there. But with wind, if you distribute large wing generators across the country and all in with a good distribution, and we have some very, very windy areas where it always is blowing. I've been in those areas. You gotta tie your hat down. Your clothes. You gotta zip up your jacket, otherwise it'll blow right off your back. We have lots of those windy areas around the country. But the point is that on average, there's always wind blowing. And if we build the infrastructure with wing generators, then in fact, it will provide us with a constant amount of energy that will be equivalent to the nuclear, coal, and natural gas power plants running all the time. So anyway, that's the entire concept of distributed energy. But I want to educate people about the absolute ridiculous claims that come in the news media. You'll see an article that'll say, so-and-so might be an offshore wind project, and they're going to provide, 500 megawatts of power. Well, no. They're going to provide about a tenth of that if they're lucky. But the news media is they're basically uneducated, very uninformed, and don't ask scientific questions. And they can pawn this off on the public because the public, U.S. public, and the world public is scientifically pretty ill-prepared to deal with these issues. And so the three-blade wind generators, once again, they don't work. They are like solar panels. The wind just blows right through those. So they don't work. And we have an installed base sufficient in the United States right now, close to 100,000 three-blade wind generators. Not a single facility, not a single energy power plant has closed because of that humongous number of three-blade wind generators. But if you calculated their nameplate energy output and multiplied by 80,000 or 100,000, you're going to come up with the total amount of energy used in the United States. So the capacity is there, but the three-blade things don't work. And so anyway, that's where the wing generator comes in. It's going to provide 100% of our energy. And that's what I'm working on daily. That's what keeps me motivated. That's what keeps me busy. So anyway, I'm running out of time. Just remember to go to my paid cast. That's where the big lecture on propulsion systems will be for this week, for June 7th, 2018, paid cast. So join that, $3.95 a month. And as I said before, I'm talking about my books. These are lectures, and it's great for students, great for students of all ages to get a real education. Also, my water filter is still sale pricing and free shipping to the 48 states. And so that webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McKenney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.